We're at the New York State Military Museum and Veterans Research Center in Saratoga Springs, New York. My name is Wayne Clark. I'm the interviewer. Sir, for the record, would you please state your full name and your date and place of birth, please?
Mario M. Albanese. I was born in Gloversville, New York on August 4, 1921.
Did you attend school in Gloversville?
Yes. I graduated from Gloversville High School in 1940.
And when you graduated, did you go on to college at that point?
Yes, I went to Siena College after World War II when I was repatriated. And I graduated from Siena in 1950.
Okay, let me go back a little bit. Do you remember where you were and what your reaction was when you heard about the bombing of Pearl Harbor?
Yes. I belonged to a basketball team called the Shamrocks back in Gloversville, and we were playing in Amsterdam, New York. Mm-hmm. And when we finished with the game, we were on our way home and we had the radio on, and that's the first that we heard about the bombing. And of course that was a great shock to us in news, and we knew instantly that our lives would change mm-hmm. because of that incident.
Now, did you experience any sort of shortages or rationing?
Oh, yes. While I was home, before I went in the Army, we had all kind of rationing, gas rationing, and food rationing, of course. And there were other items that were rationed. Yes, I lived through that, and for a while we blacked out all the lights even mm-hmm. during that period of time. I remember the street lights were on only up to a certain hour, and then after that they were shut off.
All right, and when did you enter the service?
In 1943 I was sworn in, and I left home on January 2nd or 3rd, I don't recall, right in that area.
Were you drafted or did you enlist?
I was drafted, but I had a surgical procedure. I had a hernia, and I was told that I wasn't eligible to serve. And that if I had the hernia repaired, they would take me, and that's what I did. I wanted to go because my brothers were, I had three other brothers that were in service. Mm-hmm. And
were their names?
My brother William, Attilio, and James. And all my friends were in service. I even had mm-hmm. a couple of friends who had been killed right up to that point. So naturally I wanted to do my part and be with them, so to speak. And so I had the surgical procedure and I was accepted, and I had my basic training at Fort McClellan in Alabama.
Okay, let me just ask you, why did you pick the Army over the Navy or the Marines?
Well, all my brothers were in the Army, and one was in the Air Force, but the Air Force at that time was part of the Army. Mm-hmm. And so I thought I wanted to be in the Army.
Okay.
And really, I had no particular preference mm-hmm. except to say that the Army was good enough, and that was good enough for me.
And where did you go for your basic training?
Fort McClellan in Anniston, Alabama.
And what was that like?
Well, it was a big change in my life, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed it in a sense, mm-hmm. but it was such a big change that I had to get used to the fact that I was being bossed around or limited in what I could do and where I could go.
Now, what were your drill sergeants like? Were they Southerners or Northerners?
No, as a matter of fact, most of them that I had were Northern drill men. They were, one was from Troy, and I forget his name now, He promised we'd get together after the war, but we never did. Mm-hmm. And I have some of the names of those people here today, but most of the officers, the non-coms at least, that I had were from the North. Mm-hmm. And we had four or five officers, and I'd say the ratio was more Northern than Southern.
Now, your basic training, was it infantry-oriented?
Yes, it was strictly infantry. Fort McClellan was an infantry training base, primarily.
And you recall approximately how long that basic training was?
About 4 months.
4 months?
Yes.
And once you completed your basic training, where did they send you next?
They sent me to Camp Meade in Maryland. That was a port of, well, I think it was a POM, port of mobilization. It was really a holding camp. Mm-hmm. And I spent maybe a month there before we were sent to camp in Rockland County, which was where you really stay. We stayed overnight in Rockland County. I forget the camp. I go by it. My daughters live in Rockland County.
Oh, yes. It wasn't Camp Shanks.
Yes.
Oh, it was?
Okay. Camp Shanks. And from there, when time comes, some 2 or 3 days later, we were bused or took a train to our boat. We sailed on the Île-de-France, mm-hmm. which was, at that time, the third largest ocean-going vessel.
What, was it a converted passenger liner?
Yes, it was a converted ship for the troops.
Did you go in a convoy or single ship?
We went single ship because the Île-de-France was a fast ship, mm-hmm. as the bigger ones all were. But we did have they had ash can protection, and I think air from time to time, some air protection. I believe some air protection as we got near the mainland in Europe. Okay.
Did you get seasick at all?
No, I did not. Mm-hmm. On the way over, I didn't, because the ship was a big ship, and they did tell us to eat a lot of food, you know, to weight, keep the weight down the stomach. Uh-huh.
What were your living conditions like aboard ship?
Well, my name was A, and I was way down in the bottom deck, way in the front. And I only spent one night there because I didn't like the idea that if we ever got hit,
you didn't want to go down with
the ship? I didn't want to go down the ship, not down in the ship itself. But so I slept on deck from time to time and stayed on.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
How was the food aboard ship?
Not particularly good, I must tell you that.
Uh-huh.
And well, I remember we had the English marmalade, and that's about all I lived on for a while. And for a while I couldn't hack it. But English orange pineapple marmalade or something like that.
Okay. And whereabouts did you land?
We landed in Greenock, Scotland.
Mm-hmm. And do you recall the date or approximately when?
I'd say it was mid-October of 44.
Okay.
I missed D-Day. A lot of the fellows I trained with in Alabama were in the first wave of the invasion. Mm-hmm. I don't know how it is. I was sent with some other fellas sent back while they went.
Uh-huh.
Before that, I think that happened while I was in Camp Meade.
Okay.
But in any event, we landed in Greenock, Scotland, and from there, I don't think we spent any more than 3 or 4 hours there, and we were put on a troop train, and we went through Scotland and England and into Southampton in England.
Were you sent to a replacement center?
Yes. No, right on the ship. It wasn't the center. I think that was our destination, ultimate destination, but what they did is they just put us on a train, mm-hmm. off the ship, onto a train, down through England and into Southampton Port. And from there we landed at Omaha Beach. Mm-hmm. We got off at Omaha Beach and we had to go up that big hill that was now American, and which you've seen a lot of the pictures about D-Day.
And what unit did they assign you to?
Well, when we got down there, they assigned me to the 79th Infantry Division, the 1315th Regiment. Mm-hmm. 315, did I say 315? Yes. 315th mm-hmm. Regiment. I was in H Company in heavy weapons, which is mortars and machine guns.
Now, had you been trained on mortars and machine
yes.
guns?
And rifle, of course, mm-hmm. as most infantrymen do.
Okay.
You learn to use all the weapons. Mm-hmm. And that was a heavy weapons company, H Company being a heavy weapon company.
Okay. So you landed in Omaha Beach.
Yes. And carried our big pack up the hill mm-hmm. until we went into a reception center and were assigned to various different divisions.
Okay.
Some of the fellows I went over with, whom I knew from Alabama, were assigned to different divisions.
Okay. So you were assigned as a replacement.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And once you arrived in your company or platoon, how were you received as a replacement?
Well, they were gentle enough, but they were all trying to rib us a little bit, you know, and tell us the first thing you have to learn is that you're here because you're taking the place of somebody that's dead or was killed mm-hmm. or maimed and can't return. And so always remember that and listen to what the older fellows have to tell you about how you can save yourself and at the same time be service mm-hmm. to your fellow troops.
Mm-hmm. And from that point, how long did it take before you went into combat?
Oh, I think it maybe was a day or two. I remember specifically because it was raining and we started on the march and I, after a long march and carrying weapons and ammunition, the first dead I encountered were two Americans, which really sobered me. It was a shock to me, so that I caught up with the rest of the guys real fast,
mm-hmm.
and I realized that it was no game,
mm-hmm.
and we were playing for keeps, and it was a very, very serious
uh-huh.
Matter.
Now, these two dead Americans that you saw, was that from an action that happened that day?
Yeah. Or? The funny thing is, the thing that really horrified me about seeing them, and by the way, I was always disturbed when I saw a dead GI, but I didn't feel that way when I saw a dead German, and I seen many of both.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do remember about it was that apparently they must have been hit by artillery concussion, because they were in a position like they were ready to, with their weapons in hand, and the one soldier's eyes were out. He didn't have any eyes. And you could see the both of them were like they were frozen, just as they were in position
mm-hmm.
with their weapon. And that, I think that more than anything else disturbed me
mm-hmm.
because to see them in that position.
Yeah. And how long after that was it before you actually encountered the enemy?
Well, the next day, we went up and we were told we were moving in position. My regiment was in reserve at the time when I joined them, so they moved us into the front lines. And so we marched up some, quite a ways, I would say a mile or two, I recall that. And we had shoe packs, that was the rubber type of shoe, which later on caused me a lot of problems. But in any event, we got up there and they said, well, all right, dig your foxholes. And I thought I started digging my foxhole, and I would dump the dirt out on the outside and build a little higher. And I thought I was being real smart. When I got down to the bottom, I dug it in so that I would sleep with my head under and just my feet and lower body was exposed. But I realized early in that morning, I woke up and I hear bullets flying over my foxhole and leaves, because it was falling, and then the bullets were hitting the trees and the leaves were flying and the bullets were flying. And I realized how dumb I was, because when the artillery came in, the grounds just shook up. And I said, boy, if a shell ever come anywhere near that foxhole, I'd have been buried. So I never did that again. I only dug two or three other foxholes. I'll tell you about that later. And I never dug a foxhole after that, the third one or fourth one, whatever it was. And because I had bad experiences with foxholes. The first night it was cold in the mountains, it was the Vosges Mountains we were in Alsace. And I was the other fellow in my company, or my platoon, really, we slept back to back. We tried to sleep, I couldn't sleep anyway, and I just doubled time in the foxhole trying to keep warm. And but still, you had to suffer it and keep quiet. And nothing happened that night. The next night, we moved out of there. Apparently, the riflemen were able to take some territory near a village called Embermanil. And the Free French, with their tanks, moved up alongside of us. And it was raining, and the Free French were good fighters, but they were rather loose with, you know, their lighting up places and so forth. And in nighttime, that would draw a lot of attention. So we started to dig foxhole there, and it was raining. I'll never forget it. It was raining terrible. It didn't have a raincoat. And the more I dug, the more the foxhole filled up with water. So I stopped digging and slept outside near, I'd say I'd jump in it if I had to. But I swore I'd never dig up a foxhole after that, and I didn't.
Now, you said you didn't have any rain gear. Was the rest of your clothing and equipment adequate?
Well, yeah, it was adequate. I had a heavy coat, but we took off the heavy coat. Some of the older guys, who were more experienced than I was anyway, they wouldn't wear the heavy coat, because they wanted to be able to move forward or backward, as the case may be, hurriedly, you know, without being hampered by the coat. And the coats were big and heavy, and while they protect you from the cold, but it was cumbersome to do what you had to do to protect yourself or to meet the enemy coming at you. So I never did. I mentioned the village of Embermanil, which was the first village that I was with that was captured. We were about, I would say, maybe a quarter of a mile or less outside of the village, and the lieutenant indicated to us that we ought to start digging our foxhole there. I didn't like the idea, and I asked the lieutenant, why can't we go in the village and go into the structures, the homes there that would be available to them? And I presumed that the French would be friendly to us.
Mm-hmm.
And his remark to me was, Albanese, you aren't going anywhere because there are Germans there, and they'll shoot your ass off. And I indicated to him that I'm willing to take my chances with the Germans as long as I can get into a nice warm bed or get some good food. So I said, I think we should go. And he said, well, we're not going. In any event, some of the other fellows started indicating to the lieutenant that he thought we ought to at least take our chances and go into the town and see what's what. Because I was under the impression that the town was abandoned by the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason or other, our lieutenant thought that we should stay here. He wasn't sure of it. And I think he was being too precautious.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure he had our welfare in mind, you know, our safety in mind. But from what I understood, the town was abandoned and that the French were there. And we got in town without too much difficulty, although we did have some shells. Some shells came in at us while we were working our way into town. And I remember the first place we stopped, there were about three or four of us together, was a cow barn. And I remember staying there for some rest for a while, and before you know it, some of the French natives came over and saw us, and some offered us food, and they were fairly friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And when we asked if there were any Boches around, that was the French word for the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
And they said no, that they had left. So we stayed there a day or two, and we did sleep in the homes, and that seems to have been the pattern afterwards. While there were occasions when we might have dug foxholes, I don't recall ever digging a foxhole after that night near the Free French. We were always in homes that were either, you know, where the Germans had been pushed out.
Mm-hmm.
And the natives were there. Even in Germany, was that the case. I never dug a foxhole anyway, in Alsace-Lorraine or in Germany when we entered Germany.
Okay. It says you were also in Belgium and Holland?
Yes. But while we were in Alsace, we were one of the first to cross into Germany. But as a matter of fact, I think my outfit captured some of the Maginot Line that the Germans had captured from the French and crossed over into the Siegfried Line. And that was the Germans' answer to the Maginot Line.
Mm-hmm.
And so that my outfit, the 79th Infantry Division, was way up there. We finally took Strasbourg while we were in Alsace-Lorraine. And Strasbourg was a key city and a focal point in that area. And I remember all the towns that I showed you, well, I haven't showed you, but I will be shown here on this map. Haguenau, which was, as a matter of fact, there was a program, the Band of Brothers, that had the capture of some other outfit, I think from the 9th Infantry Division in Haguenau. We were both there.
Mm-hmm.
And after some time, we were in a place called Hatten and Rittershofen, where parts of our units were cut off in Hatton. The Germans had surrounded the village. And after we were finally left Ritterhofen, where there was rather close fighting, we moved up into Hatton. The tankers and anti-tankers, our tank boys, were able to open up a hole into Hatton, and we took positions to try to relieve the encirclement by the Germans. I recall it distinctly because it was odd. It was a winter time at the, when we broke in, and the mist from the snow and the, you know, the temperature was that you couldn't see anything at all. It was like a fog for two or three days. And finally, when the sun did come out, here there was a, I would dare say from here, less than across the street, were Germans by the hundreds. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why, once the sun came, they started to run. And of course, then the boys really helped them. Mm-hmm. But that is, our boys took after them to really clear the city. But the city was finally abandoned by us. I'll never forget that. So we abandoned the city, and we left around midnight in under cover of darkness. And we then went back for a rest and told that we were going to be moved to the 9th Army. Mm-hmm. That was under General Simpson, but really under, who was under General Montgomery. He was the English general. And we were told that we were going to prepare for the Rhine crossing. The Rhine crossing was a big naval and army project, in that the Rhine was very, very wide at that point. And so that they did have Navy personnel, mm-hmm, to assist us in the taking of crossing of the Rhine.
Now, did you encounter the Russians at all?
Yeah, later on, but not then.
Okay.
Later on, we did. But we moved into Belgium for a while, and then we went into Holland to practice for the Rhine crossing. Mm-hmm. And on the day of the crossing, there were pre-dug foxholes on what would be the west side of the bank of the Rhine River, dug by the 104th Infantry, I think it was. And so that night we walked into position, and we were told when they see the green light, then we would get in to push our boats in and assault. And quite a few of the boys were killed there in my outfit, and I had some close calls there myself.
Were you wounded at all?
Well, I never was wounded, fortunately. I did have a birthmark here which was cut, and they gave me some bandage. I went back for a three-day rest. But no, I was very fortunate. As a matter of fact, I was fortunate when crossing the Rhine that before we crossed it, our platoon leader was killed, and he actually had to hit me to get in. What we did was, the boat was in place and we had the green light to go, so we wanted to drop our ammunition and our weapons in the boat and then push the boat in, and he came in and brushed me On my left side, he says, "Let me in here, Albie." He used to call me Albie, he says. And no sooner he did that, a shell came in, and I ducked, and he ducked, and he fell on me, and I knew he was dead because he was bent over backwards. He must have got his spine. He must have hit him in the back because he was just bent over backwards. His legs were way over on me, and his head was up here. And I'm sure that without him, that was meant for me. Mm-hmm. But we were able after that to push the boats over. Everybody was hollering for him. They're asking, "Where's Fox? Where's Fox?" I said, "Forget Fox. He's dead. Let's get out of here. It's too hot." And because what happened was, prior to Fox getting hit, and when we were marching into position, we had over 775 artillery pieces in place. And I understand that that was the biggest barrage up in the war up until that time. Mm-hmm. And so all along the Rhine, the 750 artillery pieces were stationed. And this was after Remagen Bridge was captured, which was just below us. And I understand that General Eisenhower and Winston Churchill were there, and the boys were saying that was the general and that was Winston Churchill, but I saw some individuals who were watching us, but I can't say for sure that it was. Uh-huh. But that's what was reported anyway. So when we got onto the other side, I put the base plate on my head as we were crossing because the Germans were still shelling us with small, rifle, mm-hmm, and artillery pieces and sky bursts. You know, they would time it so that it would burst before they hit the ground and spread the shell. And so we got over on the other side, and it was almost humorous because there were Germans, and we were getting mixed up with Germans. Guys were getting, you didn't know where the Germans were, and the Germans didn't know where we were. And so we captured a lot of Germans there. As a matter of fact, there was one whole German unit that surrendered. And our colonel, regimental colonel, come over and said to me, he says, "Listen, you better take these guys over." And I said, "Listen, Colonel, I've been sent to go to headquarters here, and as soon as I get back, I'll take them." But I think he knew I didn't want to take 400 guys back. So he took them to some holding pen where these Germans were kept. But it was really humorous, except for the fact that so many guys got hurt and killed there. Yeah. Well, I could tell you about the fact that as bad as the front lines were, there was always time for humor. Mm-hmm. I can tell you, while we were in Holland, we were going to town to see what was up. And we run into two GIs who were military policemen, and they said to me, he says, "Where does a guy go out? The war's going to finish and we want to get to see some action." I said, "You want to see some action?" I said, "You go down to H Company and ask for Lieutenant Epstein and tell him that Albie sent you. And I'm sure they'll find room for you." And before we crossed, as I told you, there were pre-dug foxholes, so when the Germans start shelling, we all jumped in the foxhole. There must have been four or five of us in one foxhole. And this big guy who wanted to get some action, he was from Minnesota, I guess. We called him Smiley. And he jumped on top of all of us, and I says, "Okay, Smiley, now you see some action. How do you feel about that?" And he says, "Well, I'm the sorriest son of a bitch that ever lived, he said. If I get past this day, I'll go back to my outfit. So there is humor at times. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what else can I tell you?
Where did you go after that?
Well, after that, we stayed in a town called Bochum. We captured the town. And it was in the Ruhr Valley. And the entire area was just bombed out practically. And we took over a house. And the trolley car used to come by there. And the house belonged to a woman they called the Frauenschaft. And they used to say that nobody liked her because when they used to get on the trolley car, she'd make them all say, Heil Hitler.
Uh-huh.
So we weren't too kind to her. We took her house over.
Mm-hmm.
And allowed her and her daughter to sleep on the third floor, and we took over the first and second floor. We were there for, well, at least a month or so when we were finally moved by vehicles over into Hammelburg. That's near Baden-Baden in Germany, Hammelburg in Germany, where we set up tents. We were told we were going to be sent to Japan and that we were going to go through the Suez Canal.
Now was the war ended at that point?
Well, no, it wasn't ended at that point. It ended while we were in Bochum. The fighting stopped after we took them, more or less,
mm-hmm.
Except for some action up around Berlin. And that's where we encountered a lot of Russians, PWs, and a lot of other nationalities, all people who were prisoners of the Germans. We set them all free.
Now, did you have any problems with the Russians at all?
No, we did not, except that they let us know that all the Russians had to obey their commands and they were not to take orders from us. They were pretty clear about that.
Mm-hmm.
They let us know. And we did have some of the PWs and displaced persons were out to take revenge on some of the Germans. And while I didn't witness any myself, some of the other fellows in my outfit did, and he knew of certain farmers who were killed, or Germans who were killed by these DPs who were workers on the forced labor on mm-hmm. the farms, and some of them took revenge on the Germans, and some of the Russians as well.
Mm-hmm.
And but in any event, we were moved by truck into Czechoslovakia. And we were in a place called Igar in Czechoslovakia, which was Sudetenland. That was the land that the Germans claimed were part of their original homeland. And that's where we run into a lot of Russians. And they wanted to come over and buy gasoline from us and some of the foods, but a lot of the guys didn't want to deal with them. I remember going into a town where they manufactured leather, and I was interested in that town because in Gloversville was a leather producing area.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went in that town. It was a beautiful summer day, and either June or July of 45, and not a soul on the street. And it was funny, here was a beautiful day, the town was unscathed, there was no damage to it whatsoever. Didn't see anybody on the street, neither soldier nor human being whatsoever. Finally, some of the natives saw us and come running out, and they were talking in Czech. Fortunately, one of my friends was Polish and he understood him. His name was Frank Matera. He just died, as a matter of fact. He understood, he was able to understand them because it's a Slavish tongue. And all of a sudden there was a big crowd on the street, and the Russian officers come out and the soldiers come out at gunpoint with us, with guns raised, and they asked us what we were doing there. And I indicated to Mr. Frank, I said, "Frank, you better tell this guy, otherwise we're going to wind up in prison. We'll leave." So after some talk between the Russians and my friend, they told us that we had to get out, but that we had a double time while they run with us out of the city. And we double timed out of the city. That was the last time we went back to that town. So by that time, the war had ended, of course, while we were still in Bochum.
Was there a lot of celebration?
Oh yeah, sure. I threw my helmet in the air, and I didn't give the lieutenant a chance to stop. I didn't care. It was over now. I almost felt like a civilian, to be honest with you. But yeah, it was great. We were celebrated, and they gave us some liquor, because only the officers were getting liquor at that time. And in any event, we were over in, we paraded, our division paraded before President Benes. Benes was a big hero in Czechoslovakia during the war and after the war. He became president of Czechoslovakia. And we paraded before them, before him. And it was quite an honor. But after that, all the boys were being transferred home. And I still had sometimes, I was a low pointer compared to some of the older guys at the time. And so I was transferred to the 1st Division and the 16th Regiment. And that's where we did guard the SS men out in a place called Langwasser. That's the big stadium you see where Hitler used to make his big bed, right there. We were right next to it. We had the SS men build huts for us. And really immediately next to us was the biggest army depot in the European theater. They would have big buildings like just butter or just coffee in one each building. It had over 50 or 60 of them, and they would be block long. And but we didn't guard them, although we helped ourselves to whatever we wanted anyway.
Now, did you have any problems with the SS guarding them?
No, except that they didn't like, we used to go to a place called the Germans did. No, the SS men didn't. They were well disciplined. They would be marched out, we would be in the towers while they were marching out, and they would sing their songs, and they had a beautiful cadence and rhythm in marching and marching out. Great. I heard the song for the first time in a long time, just a couple of weeks ago. But that was part of the trial. And we were allowed to go to the trial, but we had to subject ourselves to a pat down, you know, make sure no crazy guy would shoot at any of them. And I found it very interesting.
Now, did you see all the ones that were on trial?
Yes, I saw Goering and all of them, von Ribbentrop and all the whole group, all of them. As a matter of fact, I brought my field glasses with me, and I zeroed in on Hermann Goering. He was the big shot, you could tell. All of them would look to him for answers or congregate around him. And he saw me zeroing in, and I could see him looking at me, and he's going like this, you know. And I probably was no further away from him than from here to the, well, maybe the street. Right on the side of the street here. And it was a great experience. And
How much time did you spend at the trials?
Well, I was there at least an hour when I was there. But I was in Nuremberg, maybe 3 months at the most.
Mm-hmm.
They had baseball games there and football games in the stadiums. They had two or three stadiums in the area. The big one where he used to have his, I don't know what you would call it, where he would be there to speak, was a huge, huge place. They had, I remember after the war, they had four or five diamonds in it. That's how big it was.
Mm-hmm. That was the stadium where Hitler gave his speeches?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah, we were all present in all those buildings.
Now, when the war had ended, what were your provisions and living conditions like? You were in the German barracks?
Yes, they were German built barracks. Yes.
Mm-hmm. How was your food at that point?
Pretty good. Yes, it was good. As a matter of fact, they had German cooks.
Uh-huh.
We were in Würzburg before I went there, and Würzburg was completely burned out. It was the most burned out city in Germany. You know, all that remained were the shells of the building. It was funny. You would walk on there, and if you hollered, you'd hear the echoes.
Uh-huh.
It was always reminded me of that. It's funny. And it was a town that we took. I remember my friend and I wandered off when the action got a little slow. And as we were nearing the village itself, some artillery shells. And I said, I can't believe they would be wasting all that artillery on two guys. And we would jump in big holes that, you know, from the bombs that were, mm-hmm. that were there. And, you know, and as we jumped from one hole to the other, they still followed us until we finally got the heck out of there, because apparently we had been spotted. So it was odd. There were a lot of incidents where I look back, it's hard to believe that you could live through it.
Now, while you were overseas, did you get to see any USO shows at all?
Oh yes, I saw Mickey Rooney once, and Ingrid Bergman. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yes, we did.
And how much time did you spend in Germany after the Nuremberg trials?
I think I spent about a year, maybe a little better, about 15 months in Germany, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
No, a little less, but. Because I spent 6 months in France and some time in Belgium and Holland.
Mm-hmm. And when did you get sent back to the States?
In May of 46.
Okay.
I came back, yeah.
And you came back by boat?
Yes. I can't remember the name of the boat. It was not as big as the Ile de France.
Mm-hmm. And where did you land?
We landed in New York.
Did you receive any kind of reception?
Oh yes, there was a great reception. All the ships blew their horns at us and their fire hoses and it was just wonderful. Blew their horns.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a great reception. I'll never forget it.
Now you were discharged at that point?
Yes.
Where were
you? No, I had to go to Camp Dix.
Okay, and you were discharged.
And then I was discharged. It was a matter of a couple of days.
Okay, and when you were discharged, did you go right home?
Well, I went to my relatives. I had relatives in New Jersey, and I spent a night or two in New Jersey, and then I took a train home where I was picked up.
Back to Gloversville?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Once you got back to Gloversville, what did you do? Did you take some time off, or did you?
I took some time off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you?
It was a great time. All the guys were home, and it was like the old times in a way. But we all had changed. We knew that.
Mm-hmm. Did you make use of the what they call the 5220 club, or the?
I think I did.
Uh huh.
Yes, I did, but. I thought about working, and I knew that I didn't want to work in the mills because I know how tough it was for my father and some of my brothers who worked in the mills, the leather mills, that is.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that the glove business was rather sporadic. So I decided to go to college. As a matter of fact, I didn't decide to go to college on my own. My mother and father asked me what I had in mind, what did I intend to do? And I told my mother that I intended to find a job somewhere, either in Gloversville or in Albany. And my mother said, why don't you go to school? And I said, oh, Mom, I'm too old for that now. And she says, well, I ought to have one son. My mother and father had 11 children.
Mm-hmm.
I ought to have one son who would go to college. And so that kind of hit me hard.
So you made use of the GI Bill?
Yes. And I did it to please her. I said, well, I thought I would go to please her for a few months or a year. And I got so I liked school.
Mm-hmm.
I did like it. And I did pretty well in school considering.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the guys at that time in Siena were ex-veterans. I went on to law school at Fordham in New York City after graduating. I worked a year trying to sell insurance, but I'm no salesman.
Uh-huh.
I found that out.
So you became a lawyer?
Yes.
Okay, and you're 88 years old and you're still in practice?
Yes. I was on the bench for 10 years as county judge in Sergey in Fulton County, and I've been assigned to the Supreme Court. I've served in 10 different counties in the state as judge.
Mm-hmm.
That was for a period of 10 years, and then I went back to practice. My son is with me now, Michael,
mm-hmm.
and he's really carrying the load now. I'm semi-retired, but that's a fallacy in the law. You just don't semi-retire. You know, if you take anything out, it's a full-time job.
Uh-huh. Okay. And did you stay in contact with guys you were in the service with?
Oh, yes. Yes. This fellow, Frank Matera, I used to go to see him quite a bit, and he would come to see us from time to time. Came to my wedding.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I wrote to a lot of the other fellows, and I'd go to all the reunions we had.
Okay.
A great time. But I don't think there are many left. I'm one of the few left, as I understand it,
okay,
in my outfit.
How do you think your time in the service changed or affected your life?
Well, I think I matured a lot. Before, I was rather carefree about anything. As long as I had a job and could get out and play golf,
mm-hmm.
Go to ball games or play ball or whatever. Let me put it this way. I remember going to Kroger Lake. That was a great dance place when I was a kid, Kroger Lake was. And I couldn't wait to get to Kroger Lake after the war. But I got up to Kroger Lake when I was discharged. The first thing I did is we all went to Kroger Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And I danced once, and while I was on the dance floor, I said, what am I doing here? I realized that I didn't get the same thrill that I got before.
Mm-hmm.
And that life was more serious than, well, I had to be serious, I suppose, about life. And I call it maturity or whatever, I don't know what it was, but I just never went back and never danced after that.
Okay. And you brought some memorabilia with you today.
Yes.
Do you want to show us some of that and explain?
Well, yeah. This is my helmet. As you can see, that's the Lorraine Cross Division hat. I carried it all through Europe. It was issued to me, and that's the very hat.
Okay.
And All that you see inside is my sweat and what have you with this hammer. This is a liner.
Right.
The steel goes on top of it.
Okay. And what else you got there?
Well, this is a map of the route of the 79th Infantry Division.
Okay. Can you just pull that up? And this was all the places the division went?
Yes.
Okay, that's a nice piece.
Yeah.
Okay.
I may have a copy of this that I can send you. I don't recall
that. Actually, I think we do have a copy of that.
Do
in
that?
In the collection.
Oh, good.
I seem to recall
good.
Seeing one.
I have some other stuff here. Let me see what else I have. There's my shoulder, the emblem. I don't know if you have that.
Okay.
Of course, this is my discharge paper, by the way.
Okay. Maybe if you don't mind, we can make a copy of that for our records.
All right. And by the way, here's the, this is what was in my hat, the inside part of it that fell out.
Okay.
This is a picture of some of the fellows I was with when.
Okay, can you hold that up in front of you and I can zoom right in on it?
All right, hold on a minute.
Okay, are you in that photo?
Yes, I believe I'm on the right-hand side, let me see. Yes, I'm in the front, way on your right.
I'm trying to zoom in on it.
Yeah, right on the end. I had hair then.
Oh, okay. That's you kneeling in the front row.
Yes.
Okay.
And here's some of my friends that I served with.
Okay.
After the war in Germany.
Okay.
Befriending some little child. And this is where I was in Nuremberg with some other friends of mine that we went overseas with.
Okay. All right.
Let's see. Well, here's President Truman giving a Congressional Medal of Honor to some GI from the 42nd Division who later we had to rescue in Hatton, the place I told you where they were surrounded and some of my outfit was surrounded. And he received a Congressional Medal of Honor.
Okay.
And I have some other pictures of guys in there.
Okay.
As myself on after the war on a Jeep in Germany.
Okay.
It's not a good picture, but this is some of the shows of bombed out buildings, and I believe this was Würzburg or Nuremberg. I don't recall where I took that picture, or it was given to me anyway.
Okay. All right.
Let's see. Of course, Willie and Joe, you know, they were the favorite characters, you know that.
Oh, yes. Cartoon characters?
Yeah, I used to like to read them. And I thought this was great. I kept it, some of them. And Ernie Pyle, of course, he was killed while we were...
Yeah, he was killed over in the Pacific.
Pacific, yeah. He was primarily, though, in the Mediterranean theater and European theater.
Okay.
Let me tell you an incident of, on the day the atomic bomb was dropped, we were in Hamburg getting ready to go to Suez Canal to go to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And General McAuliffe took over our division. General McAuliffe ran the outfit in Bastogne, if you remember,
right.
And he's the officer that said nuts.
Mm-hmm.
And he came into our tent and he indicated to us that we were on a mission to go to Japan. And he just wanted to know how everybody felt about that. And nobody spoke up, but I'm not one to not speak when I'm asked to speak, and I spoke up and said I wanted to know why it was that he, along with all the other officers, had 30 days in the United States before going to Japan, and we weren't going to come home to before going to Japan. And he said, well, he said, I can't answer that, or words to that effect. You've got to ask the guys in Washington. He said, but we're going to go. And so that's the way we left it, I guess.
Okay, I've just got a few seconds left.
All right.
Anything else?
Well, here's some letters I wrote to my mother and father. They saved it.
Okay, maybe we can make some copies of that for your folder.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I think that's about it.
All right, well, thank you so much for your interview.
Okay, right.